God's glory in the heavens. The reverence of Jehovah is the beginning of wisdom. Only the foolish say in their heart, there is no God. Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. The heavens declare the glory of God. An appreciation of the infinite power of the Creator and of our own littleness should make us teachable. The study of creation is the key of knowledge. Using this key, we begin to realize that the only worthy ambition is to cooperate with our Creator's beneficent designs respecting His creation. The planets of our system, compared with our sun, are as nothing. Imagine the sun's diameter, that of a large flour barrel. Jupiter would compare as a small orange, Earth and Venus as peas, and Mercury and Mars as raspberry seeds. The sun is 300,000 times the size of our Earth. A train at 30 miles an hour could go around the Earth in 1 month, but nearly 10 years would be required for it to travel the circumference of the sun. Our day and night are the result of the Earth's rotation on its own axis, while its motion around the sun marks our year. Planets nearer the sun have shorter orbits and hence shorter years, while remote ones have longer years. A year on the planet Mercury would equal 3 of our months. On Neptune, farthest off, a year equals 164 of Earth's years. Yet our sun is only one of the fixed stars, of which the most up-to-date astronomical methods estimate there are 125 million. Around each of these fixed stars undoubtedly revolves a planetary system like our own. Thus reckoned, there are 1,000 million worlds. Even this is not the limit. If we should stand upon the farthest and dimmest star, we should no doubt from there see as many more beyond. We are appalled at the greatness of the universe. The zodiacal signs illustrate various sections of the heavens, visible at different seasons. The first day or epoch. The Genesis account tells nothing about the formation of the earth itself. It says, in the beginning the earth was, without form and void, shapeless, empty. There were neither mountains nor valleys, trees nor shrubs, rivers nor oceans, but the earth was. How long before that it had been created is not stated. The account of the days of creation given in Genesis relates not to the construction of our globe, but to the ordering of it for human habitation. There are various theories regarding its formation. We follow the one most closely harmonizing with the Bible. It is called the Valian theory. It assumes that Saturn's rings and Jupiter's belt illustrate Earth's development as a planet. The Earth was once molten, as indicated by the igneous rocks of the Azoic period, so called by scientists, but not discussed in the Bible. When the earth was molten, its water and minerals were thrown off a great distance in gaseous form. As these cooled and took shape, they constituted great rings at a distance from the earth. Gradually, the motion of the rings became different from that of the earth in proportion to the distance from the center of gravity. These rings of water and minerals, gradually approaching the earth, would be kept off by centrifugal force, particularly strong at the equator. The brooding of holy energy developed a light, probably resembling the aurora borealis, not sunlight. The sun did not appear until the fourth day. Let there be light, and there was light. Thus briefly is summed up the result of the 7,000 years styled the first day. Not that God's word would not have been sufficient for any miracle, but because he prefers to work out his glorious design along natural lines. There are scientists who claim that the earth still has one ring about it, an electrical ring, which, falling, will in a few years destroy fermentation, microbes, and parasites, and greatly assist plant and animal life. The second day or epoch. The expressions evening and morning and day cannot be understood to signify 24-hour days. For neither sun nor moon was visible until the fourth day. The earth was swathed in impenetrable darkness. The word day applies to any period or epoch, as, for instance, the day of temptation in the wilderness, 40 years. Note again that we read of the day of Christ, evidently referring to the thousand-year day in which Messiah is to be king over all the earth. In the common affairs of life, we use the word day similarly when referring to Caesar's day, Napoleon's day, etc. We follow the theory that each of the 7 days of the creative week was a period of 7,000 years. This 7 times 7,000 equals 49,000 years, ushering in a grand jubilee epoch. As one after another the encircling rings of water and minerals approached the earth, they would spread out like a great canopy, but would not be permitted to fall upon the earth because of the circumambient air referred to in Scripture as a firmament. Saturn's rings have not yet fallen. God made the firmament in the second or Paleozoic day and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. The strongly mineralized waters above the earth, held off by the firmament and centrifugal force, greatest at the equator, gradually concentrated at the two poles, where later they broke and reached the earth, forming layer after layer of mineralized earth deposited by the water which rushed from both poles toward the equator. These rings or belts of water and minerals followed each other as great deluges upon the earth, perhaps thousands of years apart. The deluge of Noah's day was the last of pure water only, heavier minerals being attracted first. Hence, minerals are generally under several layers of shale and soil. The third day or epoch, and God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land of the earth appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And the evening and the morning were the third day. The beautiful simplicity of this statement might mislead us into thinking that the gathering together of the oceans and the erection of the mountains were works of magic. While divine operations are all great and wonderful, they are usually accomplished by reasonable methods called the course of nature. And nature's course must be marked out by nature's God. The ring theory of cosmogony is that several rings had precipitated themselves upon the earth during this third epoch day. These, according to the divine intention, so increased the pressure on the crust of the earth as to cause it to buckle or wrinkle. These depressions became ocean beds, and the upheavals became mountain ranges. Thus was the work of the third day accomplished. The waters were gathered into seas and oceans, the dry land was upheaved, and began gradually to drain off in preparation for vegetation. This draining must have required a long time. We need not assume that all the continents, as we now know them, were thrown up on the third epoch day. In all probability, the American continent was thrown up much later than were Europe, Asia, and Africa. Earthquake disturbances in our day have changed the surface of the land. They give us a reasonable conception of how the divine command was executed on the third day preparatory to earth's vegetation. Appropriately, we next read, and the earth brought forth grass and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit. That is to say, vegetation began on the third or carboniferous day, though it did not reach its perfection until after the night of the sun penetrated. There are grasses and other vegetation which prosper best in darksome shade. The fourth day or epoch, and God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. It is not necessary to suppose that the sun and the moon were created after our earth. Instead, there is a much more reasonable way of viewing the matter. The sun, the moon, and the stars were created long before, but had never up to this time cast their light upon the earth because of the impenetrable veil which canopied it. The appearance of the sun and the moon on the fourth day implies that another ring broke at that time and precipitated its great mass of water and mineral upon the earth. Great gullies were washed between the mountains. The atmosphere, heavily charged with carbon, was very favorable to the development of plant life. It is supposed that the Earth still had considerable heat in its crust, that oceans were warm and highly carboniferous, and that the air was surcharged with carbon to the extent that no breathing animal could have existed. But those very conditions were extremely favorable to gigantic growths of vegetation. This giant vegetation presumably passed into a condition resembling that of the peat beds of our day. These beds of incipient coal afterwards came under great pressure, as one after another the rings of earth came down in deluges, burying vegetation under slimy deposits. Our coal fields are the result. We are not to assume that the sun and the moon shone on the earth then as now, but they were discernible even through heavy banks of fog and carbon-laden atmosphere. The influences of the sun and the moon were necessary to prepare for higher forms of plant and animal life. We may as properly lay stress on the word rule as on the word made in this text. God caused the sun to rule the day and the moon to rule the night. Besides symbolically, it is claimed that the moon represents the law covenant rule and the sun the new covenant rule. The fifth day or epoch. The carboniferous qualities of the water and atmosphere having been absorbed into the cretaceous organisms of the sea, which form beds of limestone, and into the rank vegetation which went to form the coal beds, the atmosphere of Earth began to be pure enough to permit life in breathing animals. To this period, therefore, belong the amphibious developments of animal life, such as the crocodile and other animals which can live either on land or in the water. Birds belong to this period, and in the latter part of it appeared the great mammoth and the sloth. The conflict between evolution and the Bible has been sharp. Nevertheless, unnecessary friction has been generated. Only in respect to man does the Bible declare a special direct creation of God. The statements of Genesis in respect to the lower creatures rather favor something along the lines of specialized evolution. God said, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth." This is exactly in harmony with our scientific findings, that the beginning of life came from the waters, and later extended to the birds, and later to land animals. The Darwinian theory has disappointed those who swallowed it without a sufficiency of demonstration as to its truth. Recent demonstrations show that every mixture of species and kinds, even where partly successful, means a reversion to the original standards within the third or fourth generation in plants, flowers, fruits, and in animals. The correct thought would seem to be that under divine supervision, various orders of creation were brought to a state of development and a victory of species, not to be turned aside nor thereafter altered. Not one suggestion is offered respecting human evolution from a lower creature, but quite the contrary. The Bible furnishes merely a basis for faith, that the man of God may be thoroughly equipped. The sixth day or epoch. As the carbon-laden atmosphere became more pure, vegetation became less rank. The animals changed correspondingly. The heavy bone sloth and mammoth gave place to less bony varieties of animals common today. The specialization in the case of man's creation is shown in his vast superiority over the lower animals. The first man, Adam, was an image of his creator, the highest type of fleshly or animal being. That image of his creator consisted in his moral and intellectual likeness. It is difficult to judge from present human condition all that is meant by God's image, because we have no sample of perfect humanity for comparison. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God in which Adam was created. Sin and death have reigned, and the God-likeness has been lost. All need restitution. It was toward the close of the sixth day, or approximately 42,000 years from the time of beginning the ordering of earth, that God created man. the image of God from this standpoint would mean a human being thoroughly in tune with the infinite one, one that would have no unrighteousness nor iniquity in him. Adam's transgression was not the result of ignorance nor of pure willfulness. It was the result of temptation, which his limited knowledge accentuated. His responsibility was for the knowledge he possessed. He knew that he was disobeying God. When thinking of man in the image of God, we instinctively look back to the man Christ Jesus, holy, harmless, undefiled, and separate from sinners, and like the first Adam, whose penalty he came into the world to meet. After our likeness, let him have dominion. Adam's dominion over the lower animals was like God's dominion over the universe. Angels, although in God's image, do not have a godlike dominion over creatures of a lower order. Man's dominion, overthrown by sin, is to be restored by Messiah's kingdom. The seventh day or epoch. In this presentation, we are following a line of thought which seems to be growing in acceptance among Bible students. We are living in the seventh creative epoch or day that began where the sixth day closed, after God had created Adam in his own image and likeness. God there rested from his work, from creating. He foreknew the permission of sin and its dire effects upon humanity. He foreknew the steps he would take in providing ultimately a redeemer for the race, and that the Redeemer would select a little company of believers, figuratively styled the Bride of Christ. To this Redeemer and his bride, God intended to give the dominion, control of earth. God purposed that Messiah's kingdom of righteousness should eventually uplift the willing and obedient from sin and death conditions. God rested from his work of creating in that he did not actively employ his power to overthrow sin and uplift mankind. God rested the matter in the hands of the Redeemer, Jesus, to be accomplished through his sacrifice for sin and his glorious reign for the release of mankind from sin and death. The church, God's new creation of this rest period, is heavenly, not earthly. It is claimed that according to the Bible chronology, 6,000 years from Adam have already passed. If so, the 1,000 years of Messiah's reign, which is to close the great seventh epoch day, is near at hand. According to this beautiful theory, the work of Messiah in his 1,000-year reign soon to begin will complete the creation. Not only will the race be brought to human perfection, but incidentally, man will have obtained the needed experience in respect to good and evil. Meantime, also, the earth will be gradually coming to a state of perfection. Paradise restored worldwide. Both human perfection and the perfection of the earth were fittingly represented in Eden, when Adam was in his Maker's image of king. Mother Eve created. As the creation of Adam was at the close of the sixth day, the creation of Mother Eve is indicated as having been accomplished in the beginning of the seventh day. However we view the matter, the first pair were created approximately in the beginning of the seventh day or epoch, which is now nearly completed. Mother Eve was merely a portion of Adam, separated from him for a special purpose, for the propagation of a race. Adam possessed originally in his own person the qualities masculine and feminine, which subsequently were divided between him and his wife when she was taken from his side. Adam for a time was alone in Eden, finding no congenial companionship in the beast and the bird. Mother Eve was his mate, bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. Their very difference of quality and disposition made them the more companionable to each other, because each found in the other the desired complement. They twain were one. Neither one was complete without the other. The feminine qualities of Adam's perfection he still possessed in Mother Eve. Adam was the father of the race and failed to give it life. Jesus is to become its second father, the second Adam, through whom everlasting life may be attained. Eve was associated with Adam in the sin and disobedience which brought the penalty. So, the elect church, the bride of Christ, when completed, glorified, will be his joint heir in his kingdom and his associate in the regeneration of the world during his messianic reign. Another suggestion has been offered. Jesus declared that those who attain to that resurrection will neither marry nor be given in marriage. As Adam originally possessed all the qualities of character, masculine and feminine, so humanity, when fully restored to the image and likeness of God, will reattain perfection of individuality. Sex divisions will then be no more. Earth will be filled with sufficient population. Mother Eve beguiled. The New Testament bears out the story of Genesis, of Mother Eve's deception, and that Father Adam yielded to disobedience through her influence. St. Paul declares that Adam was not deceived, and that he therefore had the greater responsibility. The scriptures everywhere portray that it is through Adam's disobedience that the condemnation passed upon his entire race. He was its responsible head. By one man, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men. The Bible account tells of Mother Eve's thirst for knowledge, and of Satan taking advantage of this, beguiling her into disobedience. We need not suppose that the serpent spoke audibly. Rather, as we say, action speaks louder than words. It is probable that the serpent spoke in this manner. God had authorized our first parents to freely eat of all the fruits of paradise, except of the species called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was forbidden for a time as a test of their loyalty. The eating of the fruit of this tree, they were forewarned, would bring upon them the curse, the death sentence. The serpent ate of various fruits and seemed especially fond of the forbidden fruit. Observation proved that the fruit did not kill the serpent, and the inference drawn by Mother Eve was that God had forbidden the use of the very best tree in Eden. Her conclusion was that God had a selfish motive in forbidding the use of that fruit, that he feared his creatures would become as wise as himself. Mother Eve did not broach these suspicions to her husband. She would eat, acquire the knowledge God was withholding, and then assist Adam to it. Adam realized the seriousness of Eve's disobedience. He thought of the long days before he had her companionship. Now he would be lonely again. In desperation, Adam determined to join Eve in the sin and its penalty. Adam's death was a slow suicide. His dying lasted 930 years. Expulsion from Eden. The word of God must stand, whether it be the word promising eternal life or the sentence of death. There is no variableness with him, neither shadow of turning. The curse, the death sentence foretold by the Lord, was executed, but not instantly. Adam was not stricken lifeless with a thunderbolt. From the very beginning, God foreknew all and had planned the redemption of Adam, Eve, and their children. To this end, Jesus came and died, the just for the unjust. As a result, ultimately, the curse of death will be removed. There shall be no more curse, no more dying, sighing or crying, nor any more pain. All of us were told, and many of us believe fully, that the penalty of Father Adam's disobedience was eternal torture. in which all of his posterity must share except a few, the saintly, the elect. Told that this was the teaching of the Bible, we accept it without proof. Now, Christian people examine their Bibles more carefully. They find that the curse or penalty for sin is a totally different one. The wages of sin is death. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. This penalty of death has rested against Adam and his family for 6,000 years. It has brought sorrow, sighing, pain, and trouble. It has blighted our lives, mentally, morally, and physically. It is this curse of death that was pronounced against Father Adam, according to the Genesis account, and also according to the New Testament. Accursed is the earth for thy sake. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth unto thee. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, until thou return unto the ground from whence thou wast taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. It is from this curse that Jesus redeemed us by dying, the just for the unjust. It is from this death curse that Messiah rescues all by a resurrection from the dead. By man came death, by man also the resurrection of the dead. Pride, jealousy, anger, murder. No children were born to Adam and Eve in Eden. They labored with sweat of face for quite a time before their firstborn came. Doubtless he was birthmarked with a jealous, unhappy disposition. Toil conduced to fretfulness in those who knew a happier lot in Eden. False finding with each other, resentment against the Creator, discontent with their lot probably marked their offspring Cain. The world has since been under a reign of sin and death. Daughters also were born to them, and later another son, Abel, of a very different disposition from their firstborn. The experience of life may have mellowed their hearts. They remembered an intimation of hope connected with their sentence, namely, that the seed of the woman should bruise the serpent's head. Abel's disposition indicates that he had a contrite heart and desired to please God. If parents realized to what extent mental conditions affect their offspring, all would strive to bestow favorable birth rates on their children. Years passed. Cain and Abel were inspired by the promise respecting the seed of the woman and the hope for recovery by divine favor. They approached the Lord with offerings to receive a blessing. Abel's sacrifice of animal life God accepted because it typified the necessity for Jesus' death as the basis for forgiveness of sin. God's rejection of Cain's offering teaches that without shedding of blood there can be no remission of sin. Cain should have procured an animal for acceptable sacrifice in obedience to the divine will. Instead, he allowed anger, malice, hatred, and strife to burn in his heart and became a murderer. St. Paul says that Abel's blood cried to God for justice against Cain, but Jesus' blood cried to God for mercy on the sinner. Every injustice cries to God for justice. By a special covenant, Jesus and his elect church lay down their lives sacrificially for Adam and his race. The better sacrifice is completed, restitution follows. Abel, the first martyr. The word martyr signifies witness, and is particularly used in reference to those who witness to the Lord's cause faithfully at the cost of suffering or death. Abel has the distinction of being God's first martyr. It is very remarkable that nearly all the martyrs have suffered at the hands of brethren. Thus, Jesus and the apostles received their persecution chiefly from Jewish brethren, sharers of the same blessed hope and promises. How strange that it should be thus. Similarly, during this gospel age, Christians have suffered martyrdom at the hands of fellow Christians. Thus the scriptures foretold, saying, Your brethren that hated you and that cast you out said, The Lord be glorified. But he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. Every martyr, in proportion to his faithfulness, will ultimately receive a crown of life, while all persecutors will ultimately be ashamed. The reign of sin and death continued for 4,000 years before God sent his Son into the world to be its Redeemer and Deliverer. The Redeemer will set it free from bondage to sin and death, but he could not do so unless first he paid the death penalty, dying, the just for the unjust. During those 4,000 years, vague promises were given from time to time, but no start was made to fulfill them until Jesus appeared. Even those vague promises were confined to the Jewish nation. Outside nations, the Gentiles, received no promises of relationship to God. They were condemned sinners, and no hopes were held out to them. As St. Paul says, they were without hope, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenant of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world. For 6,000 years, according to St. Paul, we have had a reign of sin and death. Christians are still praying for the blessed day of Messiah, for Satan's binding. Then blessings will displace sin, sorrow, and death. Sorrow and mourning begun. The first death in Adam's family must have cast a great shadow. The hope centered in the divine promise that the seed of the woman should bruise the serpent's head, was temporarily snuffed out. Shortly after, Seth was born. His name indicates that his parents hoped that he would be the man promised of the Lord, not seeing that the promised one would be the Messiah, who would come long afterward and for whose work the world still waits. Although we speak of this as the first death, we must not forget that from the divine standpoint, Adam and his race were already dead, in that none can regain everlasting life except through the Redeemer's work of sin atonement. At present, the population of the world consists of 1,600 million, 90,000 dying every day. It is undoubtedly fortunate for our fallen race that we cannot appreciate deeply the sorrows and difficulties of others. Each individual, each family, has about as large a share of sorrow as it can properly bear. Indeed, the poet, realizing the folly of unrestrained grief, has well sung, Go bury thy sorrow. The world has its share. Go bury it deeply. Go hide it with care. Hope, joy, and peace come to us through the divine promise that the time is coming when there shall be no more sorrow or dying, no more sin or pain. For Messiah's kingdom shall conquer sin and death and cause God's will to be done on earth as fully as it is now done in heaven. Our experiences with sin and its penalty should make us all sympathetic. We should do nothing to add to the sorrow of others, but everything to relieve. The words of Jesus touch this chord of sympathy. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. There is no rest for the weary of heart except in union with Christ.
What we have just seen surely has broadened our conception of our great Creator's wisdom, justice, power, and love. Let us arise and reverently join in one verse of that beautiful hymn, Nearer, My God, to Thee, Nearer to Thee. Sons of God, daughters of men, long before man's creation, angels were created. Yet sin was unknown until Adam's day. The beginning of sin, according to the Bible, was in the Garden of Eden. Lucifer, an angel of very high rank, had long cherished in his heart ambitious designs. If opportunity ever offered, he would show God and the angels his grand scheme. His thought is expressed by the prophet. I would ascend above the stars, angels. I would be as the Most High, an emperor. When Lucifer beheld the first human pair, he was tempted to try his experiment. They were a new order of beings in God's moral image. They had procreative powers which no angel possessed. Their offspring filling the earth would be his subject, through whom he would work out his ambitious schemes. Thus Lucifer became Satan, God's opponent. All the holy angels were bewildered. His was the first rebellion against the Almighty's laws. No punishment followed, and the angels queried whether or not God was able to enforce his laws. Centuries rolled on. The human family was wasting. God's penalty, dying, thou shalt die, was gradually being enforced. Satan realized that his kingdom of dying subjects would make but a poor showing ever. He conceived a plan to outwit God and develop a new order of beings, hybridized humans infused with superior vitality. The angels possessed the God-given power of materialization. They could appear in human bodies resembling those of men. The Bible attests this. The angels were permitted contact with the fallen race to prove whether they could bring mankind back to God. The record of Genesis is that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took unto themselves wives of all they preferred. Thus the angels became the fathers of a new race, distinct from Adam. The record is that these were giants, physically and intellectually, men of renown who filled the earth with violence. While the ark was preparing, the disloyal course of the angels apparently continued for centuries without any outward manifestation of God's ability to check them. Thus all the holy angels were tested, and all who chose were disobedient in the days of Noah. Noah's family was singled out as exceptional in the statement, now Noah was perfect in his generation, implying that few or no others were perfectly generated of pure Adamic stock. Noah's family, therefore, included all the uncontaminated, only 8 persons. They, by divine command, built the ark, and thus witnessed to the world the divine intention respecting a deluge. Noah's message respecting a divine judgment by a deluge seemed ridiculous. Until the deluge, there was no rain. The last of the great rains which then flooded the earth was of pure water. For centuries it was spread out over the firmament. The whole earth was a great hothouse. There were practically no changes of season nor storms, because the great water canopy preserved it in perpetual summer. Of that period we read, for as yet there was no rain on the earth. Noah, the preacher of righteousness, was mocked and considered a fool because of his faith in God's word, just as others of the Lord's people at various times have been mocked by those who lack faith and are yet mocked. Finally, the deluge came. The fountains of the great deep canopy were broken up. The breaking of the canopy precipitated millions of tons of water at both poles, forming two great tidal waves, covering the earth for a great depth, deepening the ocean bed, and throwing up additional mountains. The cradle of the world is supposed to have been in Armenia. Geology tells us that the land of that vicinity was at one time a quiet settling farm, as evidenced by heavy alluvial deposits. In this vicinity, the ark floated, and by divine protection landed on Mount Ararat, its precious place, for the world's new star. Nephilim destroyed. The account of the fall of the angels from being sons of God to be demons helps us to understand why God decreed the deluge to wipe out all of the human race except Noah and his family. We perceive that God from the first intended to deal only with Adam and his family. The giant sons of the fallen angels, Nephilim, came into being contrary to the divine will. Hence, properly, no provision was to be made for them. They never had a right to life, nor will they have a resurrection. On the other hand, all of Adam's posterity, redeemed by Jesus' death, must be recovered from death, with full opportunity to secure everlasting life. After the deluge, the demon angels dematerialized, resumed their spirit condition. St. Peter and St. Jude reveal the penalty inflicted upon them. Those angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, spirit condition, God restrained under chains, restraints of darkness, under the judgment of the great day. The liberties of the fallen angels, demons, were restrained. They are unable to use deceptions in the light, unable to materialize as formerly. Note, however, that the limitation unto implies that when the great day of wrath shall come, these fallen angels will be permitted to materialize and become potent factors in the strife. Other scriptures indicate that these fallen angels will have much to do with the great time of trouble with which this age will close and in which Messiah's kingdom will be inaugurated. These fallen angels will cast to Tartarus, our earth's atmosphere. Satan, a cherub angel of higher rank, is styled the prince of demons. They are not in some far-off place stoking fires, but keep as close to humanity as possible. Not permitted to materialize, they seek to obsess, to demonize by clairvoyance and clairaudience. Mankind would properly resent them if their true character were known. They therefore personate the dead, communicating through spirit medium. The end of that age. In the scriptures, the expression end of the world is frequently used. St. Peter tells us that the world came to an end in the deluge. It was not the earth which came to an end, merely that order or condition of things which prevailed prior to the deluge ceased there. A new world, a new order of things was there ushered in. This is in strict accordance with the proper translation of the Greek. The common translation, unfortunately, has deceived many. We would better read end of the age, not end of the world. Ages may end and be succeeded by other ages, but the Bible declares that the earth abideth forever, that God formed it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. It has never been thoroughly habitable, nor has it ever been inhabited in the proper sense of the term. The work of Messiah's kingdom will be to make God's footstool glorious.
and fit for those restored to his favor. His further work will be to uplift man and restore him to all that was lost in Eden and redeemed at Calvary. He will destroy only the incorrigible. In the new order of things started by Noah and his family, God allowed humanity to have its way and to work out its own schemes without divine interference, except in extreme cases. He allowed the world to learn lessons while he carried out his own great plan, of which redemption is the center and Messiah's kingdom the circumference for the recovery of mankind from their fallen estate. The development of God's plan has been long from the human standpoint, but not so from the divine, for we read, 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday. And again, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. During 6 of these 1,000-year days, in which he rests or desists from interfering with the world's affairs, God has permitted a reign of evil, but his arrangements are complete, whereby Messiah, the Redeemer, will fully restore all the willing and obedient to all that Adam forfeited.